C1S. Number 21A.
We started this morning with theology, with the tone of life, showing that if we understand the section on science, namely our unity with mind and spirit and soul and principle, that then we have touched a living principle, a principle that is life. And life is spontaneous, is unrestricted, is boundless, limitless, and therefore we can see that we can take part in this enormous stream of life as a factor of evolution in this life, and going with life and not against life, if in our mind, the first subtone, we have an unrestricted openness for the possibilities of life to break through, through any channel, through any possibility, use any situation, any occasion, and that therefore our whole heart should go out to be free, unlimited, big, and so break down the narrowness of thinking. The impulsion of life, which is unrestricted, has in itself the power to break down everything within us which is narrow, limited, small, pettiness. And this is so necessary, I feel, for being able to help any movement, any development, anything that should go forward. In the tone, subtone of spirit, then, we see that if we have that unity with the one life, which knows no other life but God, that this has in itself the power to knock down any material resistance, that nothing can stand in the way of life, that life is like a bulldozer, you say bulldozer? Yes, like a steamroller or a centurion tank. You had the centurion tank, so in the war, just seems like that. It comes and nothing can resist it. It just goes over it. And so we can see that we must not be afraid that any resistance can be bigger than life, than the life impulsion. In the subtone of spirit, the unrestrictedness of life was shown that it is unlimited, that it is undivided, that the whole garment of Christ is always whole, and that it cannot be torn apart so that the Christ only would work for certain factors or section of life, that the undividedness of life really touches every department of life, of the social life, of physical life, of physiological life, of psychological life, of biological life, of corporeal life. It touches every department of being and acts there as a leaven of life to bring out that which life wants to bring out. Then in the subtone of true of principle, we felt that sense that this life power, which is the healing power, which is the healing spirit, is not restricted to a person like Jesus, that it is an impersonal life, and therefore that this healing power and the healing effect of life stands at the disposition of everyone. It is impersonal and is available at any time and through every occasion. And now we come to the subtone of life, life as life, which I have epitomized like this: to possess the Christ spirit and to follow the Christ example is the theology of Christianity. In here, we feel the compulsion of life to be a follower of the Christ Spirit. The text deems with renderings like this, to be Christ-like, to possess the Christ Spirit, to follow the Christ example, and to heal the sick and the sinning. Jesus is here represented as being the precedent for all Christianity. Just as I used the term prototype this morning for Jesus, that Jesus was that big mutation in evolution which ushered in a new type of man, the Christ man, that man which is to which belongs the future, and of which Dunuy said that it is the prototype of the true man which will appear perhaps in a million years. Well, it's a bit long, a million years. No, a billion years, not only a million, a billion years. Well, that Christ man is here and now, and is available to each one of us, right here and now. It's what it demands is a change of consciousness, the willingness to accept that we are the Christ man and have the mind of Christ. It isn't something that is dependent on an evolutionary time. It's dependent on an evolutionary consciousness. Can we evolve in consciousness and revolve in consciousness so that we are willing to change? See, now comes the scientist which has the faculty to change. That's why we had yesterday in the tone of principle and as mine that interesting page on change. The scientist is willing to change his mind. The theologian is not willing to change his mind. He is willing to stick to the old, to get so rusty that they are really dusty. That's a nice rendering, huh? To get so rusty has to be dusty. Copyright. The new sense, the living sense of theology is to be new in thinking, to rethink anew, not to think over the old, but if we go to think over the old, then only for the purpose of seeing it new. See, it is said of Einstein that what enabled him in the first instance to see the theory of relativity, which was breaking Newton's law, the neck, or was breaking the neck to Newton's law, was that he was thinking over and over Newton's law, over hundreds of times, until he found where there was missing something, by introducing then the time element. And so he was not rethinking Newton's law in order to know it better, but to question it. So if we do rethinking that which has said of old, let's be clear that we rethink it always with the intention to see a new light in it, a higher light in it. Then it is progressive, and then it is not going to be rusty and dusty. So here in Life as Life, it shows that the impulsion of life asks us and impels us to follow this new sense of the Christ Spirit, and that it is this very life impulsion which enables us really to lay down the false sense of theology and the false sense of life, to leave the old and to accept the new. As it is said here then on page 139, line 1, to forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let's see that the solution which we get in science compared with when we are thinking on the plane of metaphysics is that the laying down of the mortal, to forsake the wrong way, is not an effort which we do morally or in consciousness, that it is something much more gracious, that by finding our inward unity with life, Just as we saw yesterday, that if we see that nothing is ever going on, but life, truth and love, having its impact on life on the level of Christian Science, having its impact on our life, then the law of life, truth and love is forcing everything within our lives to give itself up and to bring to birth and bring to forward that which is in line with the unfoldment of true life. And then that is a way of grace and no more a way of sweating and agony. So if we stick always in this chapter to write to the starting point of the chapter, that we have discovered the eternal, the divine laws of life, truth and love, and see the whole chapter under this enormous impulsion of the workings of life, truth and love, then all these subjects are graceful subjects. Here it shows that this very action in consciousness that we entertain of life, truth and love as eternal laws of spontaneity, of eternal laws of self-realization, of eternal laws of self-integration in the one plane of being, that this has the power in itself to throw out of our consciousness, to throw out of our life all that which stands in the way of our life, and to strengthen within us that rest which is always there, which is of the nature of life, truth and love, then the way of laying down the mortal is a gracious way, a loving way of going forward. And that is also true in what she says right afterwards in the next paragraph, where she shows that all new reforms all through the Christian and Jewish era were attended by persecution and bloodshed, that today we really should see how we can stem this, as she says, the tide of sectarian bitterness whenever it flows inward. Today we should be able, through what we understand of the term of absolute Christian Science, the laws of life, truth and love, to stem the tide of sectarian bitterness whenever it flows inward. Because life will free us of that thought that the idea can only unfold in certain narrow channels and through certain people or through certain organization or groups or anything like that. If it frees us to that point where we can see that everything is under the impulsion of life, that whatever happens on the whole universe is under this impulsion, then we are not in danger of trying to be bitter against what can happen elsewhere and which seems to be going against the idea, or which seems to be accusing the idea. It gives us a freedom to see that whatever happens in the line of spiritual unfoldment, wherever it is, no matter how small it is or how imperfect it still may be, it's still a motion of life, truth and love. Sectarian bitterness comes in when we don't believe that only God is going on, when we believe that error is mightier than truth, when we believe what the next subject then will tell us, when we believe that error can stop the ever going on of truth. Then we become sectarian, then we begin to fight, then we begin to miscredit other lines of thinking and doing things. Here, let's be clear that this is usually the sign of a religion or of a church, that it becomes at once sectarian and it becomes at once bitter against everything which does not conform with their ideals, against everything which does not fit into their pattern of looking at things. This is narrow. This is not the boundlessness of life. It is not acknowledging that God is all in all and ever present, and that God can use any situation, whatever that situation is, can use for the good. We remember so well for John Dolly, whatever happened, which we may call something very bad happened, his first reaction would always be, there is a blessing behind it. There is a blessing behind it. He never let any bitterness, any accusation, any depression or anything come in, whatever happens. And naturally, this is then the pinnacle of the textbook in the Apocalypse, where she shows that the angel, no matter if it looks like seven vials full of the last plagues, as the sum total of human misery, that if we look properly at it, it is something very different. I show you the bride. So, a sign which should show itself forth among us as the proof that we have understood something about the fullness of life, the unrestrictedness of life, should be that we have no more sectarian bitterness against other lines of thinking and other lines of looking at God and spiritual things, but that we take them in, not as authority, because we may not agree with them, but as a way how these people, how that stage of unfoldment can take the divine idea, that it is just the way they can take it and can unfold. It's the language, how it speaks to them, and just as it speaks to us in a different way, gives a great sense of tolerance, though we don't need to fall into fatalism, where we just feel that everything that happens is okay. But when we know life as life, then we certainly will know that life will be able to use any situation for the best of everything and for the whole. Then we come to the next stone of truth, which is rather a nicely laid out, a gem in itself, and I have tried to epitomize it like this, that the healing Christ cannot be subdued by error. I don't know if that is, I think she uses that term, subdued. What she really wants to show here, that the stone which the builders have rejected, that it has just the same become the head of the corner, that nothing in the world can prevent the idea from becoming the headstone, so that error is not able to subdue the Christ idea. This is a very important point, because we know only too well from various church organizations that in a church there is always a sense that you have to protect the truth against error. Now, this is a very small God which needs us to protect God from being God and from establishing his idea. So we must see through this argument and see that truth is establishing itself and protecting itself, and that no attack on the truth, no misrepresentation of the truth, no obscuring of the truth can really defy the idea of truth to establish itself. Life as truth. See, the impulsion of life is truth. This means that the impulsion of life can cope with any error that tries to stand up against truth. And this is shown through various subtones, which are rather clear-cut in the text. Mostly the side headings are already indicating the subtones. For instance, the very first point which he points out is the marginal heading, Science Obscured. So what she presents here in Science Obscured is that no error, whatever it is, can forever or definitely or finally obscure the science of being. That, for instance, she takes the Bible, that nothing can forever obscure the true sense of the Bible. She takes here various examples and says, well, what could obscure to some extent the divine science of the Bible? It is those decisions by vote of church councils. We know that through especially church councils, we have them in the Roman Catholic Church, but actually also in other churches through the centuries, these councils tried to obscure the true message of the Bible, the true interspiritual interpretation of the Bible. But could they really subdue the truth? No, because every attempt, be it through a false decision of the church council, just had as its effect that there were enough dissenters to carry the torch of truth forward. That in spite of all what happened in that Roman Catholic Church, we have today a non-Roman Catholic Church going forward and being free and trying to see the truth and uncovering the truth in the Bible. She speaks about the manifest mistakes in the ancient versions of the Bible, that even that could not forever obscure the true meaning of the Bible. She speaks here about the 30,000 different readings of the Old Testament and the 300,000 different readings of the New Testament. I really don't know where she gets that from. I never read that in any commentary or anywhere. I don't know where she has it from. It sounds a lot to have 300,000 different readings of the New Testament. I don't know what she means by it. I don't think there are 300,000 manuscripts on the New Testament. So whatever she meant by it, it's indicating naturally that we know that there are so and so many manuscripts which don't coincide with each other on every dot and comma. And though there are such a lot of mistakes in the ancient versions, then the many mistakes by copying those manuscripts, by translating those manuscripts, all those mistakes, could they obscure the Bible? No. See, truth is even bigger than Bible mistakes. I remember when we did a tome in a class, we did Nahum, and in Nahum, especially in the Minor Prophets, one always finds quite a few passages where the Bible commentary says it is a corrupt, that the text is corrupt, as they call it, where they don't know exactly what the original text is, and then every translator tries to make out what he thinks may have been there. And we were comparing there a certain passage in the Tone of Soul, where we had about 10 different Bibles in English, in German, just English and German. Various translation, and each translation was very different, not just slightly different, but very different, really, in the picture used, in the example, in the symbolism used. And in each version, when we said, well, what does it mean spiritually? We always had the same spiritual interpretation, whatever the translation was. To me, that occasion was such a proof that even an incorrect and faulty translation or even a missing original text for some part cannot rob us of the spiritual understanding of the text, that the spiritual sense just comes out just the same. And this confirms what she says here, that all those mistakes could not wholly obscure the divine signs of the scriptures seen from Genesis to Revelation. The big picture still stands. Cannot all these many mistakes that may have happened by copies and so on, they could not touch the truth, and certainly they cannot touch the spiritual sense of the Bible. You know that today so much work is being given on new translations of the Bible. Here in England too, you have various new translations by what is called Rieu and Phillips, and then the New English Bible, and I don't know what. In the German language, we have about 6 or 7 new translations only since the last war. Completely new translation by individuals or by groups or by churches. We hear that now the Roman Catholic Church, together with the Protestant Church, want to bring out a combined translation and so on. A lot of work is being given to a new translation, but I don't think it will help very much. Perhaps it even is not too good. Just remember what we were seeing about those that passage in the New English translation about the woman that took 3 measures of meal, and that they translated how much it was, 25 hundredweight or something like that. See, taking away the spirit of the whole thing. So that even all the effort that today is put into this translation, just finding out if there is a comma missing or not a comma missing, they found out that in this Dead Sea Scrolls on Isaiah, mostly there were only commas that were put on the wrong side or full stops and so on. All that work that goes into it seems to be rather wasted, because the spiritual sense of the Bible is already there, and I'm quite sure that even if we had the original and the perfect translation of the original, that wouldn't save the world. The theologians wouldn't get the spiritual sense of it if they knew where the comma is and where it doesn't need to be. Just think, for instance, what an enormous publicity was being given at the time when Dr. Lamsa translated the Bible from the Aramaic, which is really a nice translation and in many ways reads easier and more understandable perhaps for the illumined reader, how he made propaganda all over America, everywhere, because the Aramaic shows that passage where it says, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle than for a rich man to come into the kingdom of God. Well, he found in the Aramaic it is written, it is easier for a rope to go through the eye of a needle. Well, what's the difference now? What's the difference if the symbolism is it is easier for a camel or easier for a rope to go out to the eye of a needle? Both can't go through. Well, that's the point. So what have we gained spiritually and understandingly about this whole thing? But he goes around, he's a wonderful man. I don't want to say anything against him. But we must be clear that the spiritual sense of the Bible is the main thing, and that even if we go back to our old fine English Bible, King James Bible you have, or we go back to Luther's translation, which stands already a few hundred years, they still ring true, and perhaps still ring truer than all the newest translation, because those people were like Luther, they were translating that Bible in the spirit of the Bible. They were in a fight, in an inward great revolution, and they had to put up really or mobilize their best characteristics and the best they had in themselves to bring out the true sense of the Bible. And that's something very different than when well-paid scientists and philosophers and theologians sit together and just discuss about every little thing, and then agree in, not in church council, but in translation committees and so on, which words they shall put in. I think those who translate the Bible out of inspiration and don't have to ask 40 other people if they agree or not agree, I think it is a greater impulsion from the life of being that dictates them to do it than the other way around. So here is the first point, that errors that creep in into the Bible could not even destroy or mar the meaning of the Bible. Our spiritual sense will always detect when there is perhaps something wrong, and we just go over it, because within the whole of the text it will always be set right.